Imagine, if you will, spending, I don't know, maybe 20 years of your life building your absolute dream house.
Right, a total labor of love.
Exactly. You lay every brick by hand, you carve the woodwork, you meticulously design every single room.
You're putting your heart into it.
Yeah, it represents decades of your energy, your wealth, and your love. And then, one Tuesday morning, someone cuts you off in traffic.
Okay.
You get so incredibly enraged by this minor slight that you drive straight home, grab a can of gasoline, and just burn your own beautiful house to the ground.
I mean, if you heard a story like that on the news, you would think that person had completely lost their mind.
It sounds totally insane,
Or
right?
completely irrational.
But according to a profound lineage of wisdom stretching back over 1,000 years, that is exactly what we do to our own minds, to our own spiritual bank accounts.
Yeah, every single time we lose our temper.
Welcome to today's deep dive into the source material. We are embarking on a journey today that is, it's going to challenge some of our most deeply held assumptions.
Assumptions about justice, retaliation, and ultimately peace of mind.
Exactly. We're speaking directly to you, our fellow practitioner, because this isn't just theory.
No, it's a very practical terrain we are exploring today. We are going to be immersing ourselves in a highly revered transmission of established wisdom.
And this is specifically from the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, right?
Yes. Specifically, we are looking at the extensive teachings given by Kenzo Rinpoche. He gave these over the course of 1988 and 1989.
At Buddha House in Adelaide, Australia.
That's the one. He was providing this meticulous, highly systematic commentary on Chapter 6 of the Bodhicaryavatara.
Which translates to engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds, composed by the 8th century Indian master Shantideva.
Right. And, you know, if you've spent time studying Eastern philosophy, you know that Shantideva's text is an absolute masterpiece.
It has this structural genius to it that is so easy to miss on a first casual reading.
It really does. Because if you look at the flow of the text, the first three chapters are designed entirely to generate bodhicitta.
That precious awakening heart, the altruistic intention to achieve full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings.
Exactly, the absolute foundation of the Mahayana path.
Yeah.
Then chapters 4 and 5 are there to guard that intention.
Right, to build a fortress of conscientiousness and introspection around it so you just don't lose it.
But then you reach chapter 6.
Ah, chapter six.
And chapter 6 is dedicated in its massive entirety to a single solitary topic.
Shanti.
Yes, Kranti, patience or forbearance.
And it forces us to ask a really pragmatic question. Why?
Why does this one specific perfection, out of all the virtues a practitioner is supposed to cultivate, require an entire chapter?
Yeah, a chapter of rigorous, uncompromising, almost surgical focus. Why not a whole chapter dedicated just to
Or
generosity?
ethical discipline, right?
Right. The answer goes straight to the heart of what we mentioned with that burning house analogy at the start.
The entire chapter is dedicated to patience because there is a single emotion that stands as the absolute greatest threat to a bodhisattva's vows.
And that emotion is anger.
Anger. If bodhicitta is the foundation of the Mahayana path, anger is the ultimate earthquake.
Wow, the ultimate earthquake. So our mission today is to systematically walk through Khyentse Rinpoche's explanation of Shantideva's logic.
And we should be clear, we aren't here to discover new information or to invent novel theories.
No, not at all. We are here as students of the Dharma to receive, unpack, and deeply reflect upon the systematic dismantling of our greatest inner enemy.
I think dismantling is the perfect word there. Because Rinpoche doesn't just tell us, you know, don't be angry.
Right, that would be useless.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He takes the engine of anger apart piece by piece so we can see exactly how it works.
But before we can even begin to cultivate patience, Khyentse Rinpoche insists that we must understand exactly what is at stake.
When we lose it, you mean?
Yeah, when we lose our temper, we have to look at what I would call the devastating mathematics of anger.
That is precisely where the teaching begins. Why is anger universally considered by the great masters to be the absolute worst of the afflictive emotions?
Right, and it comes down to this concept of dual negativity.
Yes, the dual negativity.
I really want to pause and unpack this because the first time I encountered this concept, it fundamentally shifted how I viewed my own mind.
It is a profound shift.
We all know that afflictive emotions, whether it's deep attachment, grasping, pride, or jealousy, they're all negative, right?
Right, they all create negative karma. They all bind us to cyclic existence.
But anger does something uniquely horrific.
It does. Let's look at attachment as a point of contrast. Say you experience a moment of intense attachment.
like grasping desperately at a material possession.
Or relationship or worldly status. You are indeed acting out of delusion.
Right, you're creating negative karma that will ripen as future suffering.
Exactly. However, that moment of attachment does not necessarily destroy the positive karma.
The merit.
The merit, yes.
Yeah.
The merit that you have previously accumulated through acts of generosity or patience or ethical discipline.
So your bank account of positive potential remains intact.
Even if you are simultaneously racking up a separate debt on a credit card, so to speak.
Okay, but anger does both.
It does both. It is a negative action in itself, creating profound causes for future suffering, and it possesses the unique, terrifying power to actively incinerate previously accumulated positive potential.
And the karmic math that Khenpo Rinpoche provides here is just staggering.
It really is hard for the modern mind to even compute.
He explains that a single moment of anger can destroy the positive energy accumulated over 100 great eons.
100 great eons.
And just for context, an eon isn't just 1,000 years, or even 1,000,000 years.
No, in Buddhist cosmology, a great eon is a cosmic time unit encompassing the entire life cycle of a universe.
From its creation, its period of abiding, its destruction, and the period of total emptiness before the next universe forms.
100 of those cycles.
All the merit accumulated through lifetimes of trying to be a good person gone. Being generous, holding vows gone in a flash of temper.
And Khenpo Rinpoche makes a crucial distinction here regarding the object of our anger.
Right, who we are actually getting mad at.
Yes. That massive destruction, 100 eons of merit, occurs specifically if that anger is directed at highly realized beings like Buddhas or Bodhisattvas.
But what if it's just an ordinary person?
Even if the anger is directed at ordinary sentient beings, beings of equal realization to ourselves, the destruction of positive potential is still vast.
Still deeply damaging to our spiritual progress.
Absolutely.
But, you know, this is where my modern skeptical mind always hits a wall.
How so?
How does this actually work? What is the actual mechanism here? It sounds almost like magic.
Or divine punishment.
Exactly. How does a momentary mental state today reach backward in time, so to speak, to destroy the fruits of good deeds that I did last year?
Or in a past life.
Right. Yeah. I need to understand the physics of this.
It is a completely valid question. And it is vital to understand that there is no magic or divine punishment involved here.
Okay, so what is it?
The mechanism is deeply logical when we understand the fundamental law of cause and effect. To see how anger destroys merit, we have to look at the nature of both the seed and the fruit.
Okay, I'm following.
What is the fundamental result or fruit of any positive action? It is happiness.
Right. Positive actions, generosity, kindness, they are the karmic seeds.
And the experience of happiness and well-being is the inevitable fruit. Now, what is the fundamental nature of anger?
Well, if you look closely at the experience of rage in your own mind, what is it doing? It is the absolute destruction of happiness.
Exactly. Anger and happiness cannot coexist in the mind at the exact same moment.
That is undeniably true. You cannot be fiercely, violently furious and simultaneously peaceful and joyful.
The mind can only hold one of those states at the forefront. Because anger actively destroys the experience of happiness, it is effectively destroying the fruit of your past positive actions.
Wow. Okay, that makes so much sense.
And in the mechanics of karma, if you definitively destroy the capacity for a fruit to ripen, you have effectively killed the root.
You've rendered those past seeds of merit completely sterile.
They can no longer produce the happiness they were destined to create because you've introduced a mental state that is the exact antithesis of their result.
If we go back to the orchard analogy, it's like spending a decade meticulously planting apple trees.
Right. You till the soil, you plant the seeds, you water them every single day.
The seeds are there. The work was done. But then, in one moment of rage, you pour thousands of gallons of toxic salt over the entire field.
The seeds haven't vanished.
But the environment has been rendered so completely toxic that nothing can ever grow from them.
You haven't just ruined today's harvest. You've ruined the potential of the seeds themselves.
That is terrifying.
It is a perfect visualization of the process, though. And Khenpo Rinpoche emphasizes that we don't just see this playing out in abstract cosmic time frame.
Over multiple lifetimes.
Right. We see this exact dynamic in our immediate, direct, present life experience. He moves us right from the cosmic scale down into the living room.
Think about your own life. The moment anger arises, what actually happens to your present reality?
Your peace of mind is instantly shattered.
It doesn't matter how luxurious your surroundings are. You could be on a beautiful vacation in a five-star resort, eating your favorite food.
But if you get a text message that makes you furious, you are suddenly in hell.
The physical comfort cannot penetrate the mental suffering.
And Khyentse Rinpoche points out how it completely blinds us. Under the power of anger, all of our rational discernment evaporates.
Suddenly, even our loved ones become targets of our harm.
The people who have shown us the greatest kindness, our family, our closest friends.
We say things in a five-minute argument that can irrevocably damage a 20-year marriage.
It's like an emotional hand grenade. An entire household's harmony is ruined by one person's anger.
It radiates out. A peaceful home becomes a war zone simply because one person brought this toxic energy through the front door.
And Rinpoche even scales this up, noting that the disharmony of a country, the violence in our societies, and ultimately the wars in the world, they can all be traced back to this exact same mechanism.
The unpacified anger within individual minds.
Precisely. And if we look forward beyond the present moment, the future ramifications are equally severe.
Because habituation to anger creates very specific karmic latencies in the mindstream.
Rinpoche explains that indulging in anger, allowing it to become a defining trait of our personality, leads inevitably to lower rebirths.
He speaks of rebirth as hell beings experiencing unimaginable agony.
Or as hungry ghosts consumed by insatiable frustration.
He also mentioned something really fascinating. Rebirth is creatures that inspire automatic fear and revulsion in others.
Yes, such as venomous snakes or scorpions.
I remember reading that and thinking how poetic and tragic that is.
It really is.
If your mind is constantly radiating hostility and a desire to strike out at others, your outward form eventually becomes a direct reflection of that inner hostility.
You become an entity that others instinctively want to kill or run away from.
Your physical form becomes a prison built by your own anger.
Yes, the outer mirrors the inner. But to contrast this bleak reality, Khyentse Rinpoche cites the great Indian master Chandrakirti.
And Chandrakirti taught the results of the exact opposite habituation, right?
He did. If anger makes us ugly, isolated, and feared, Chandrakirti says that habituation to patience enduring harm without retaliation yields the exact opposite in future lives.
And what are the fruits of patience? Rinpoche says it yields a beautiful, pleasing physical body.
It yields a fundamentally kind heart.
A natural magnetism where others simply like being around you and trust you instinctively.
But most crucially, patience provides the quiet, stable ground upon which true wisdom can actually grow.
You cannot realize the subtle nature of reality. You cannot realize emptiness if your mind is constantly churning with agitation and grievance.
Exactly. So if we accept this premise, if we look honestly at our own experience and recognize anger as our greatest inner adversary.
Possessing this dual negative power to create intense suffering while simultaneously destroying our hard-won merit.
The next logical question for any serious practitioner is practical.
How does this enemy actually infiltrate the mind?
We need to understand the anatomy and the mechanics of anger.
Right. We need to dissect it. We have to map the battlefield before we can defend it.
And Khyentse Rinpoche systematically lays out this incredible grid of anger's origins.
He identifies 9 specific causes, which are grouped under 3 main roots. Let's really look closely at this grid.
Because it covers almost every human conflict.
The 3 roots of anger are harm directed at oneself, harm directed at one's loved ones, and help given to one's enemies.
And Shantideva multiplies those 3 roots by 3 time frames, past, present, and future.
So let's walk through the math of our grievances. First, I am angry because someone harmed me in the past.
Or they are actively harming you right now.
Or I anticipate that they will harm me in the future. That's 3.
Then the second root. Someone harmed my loved ones, my friends, or my family in the past.
Or they are harming them right now.
Or they are threatening to harm them in the future. That's another 3, making 6.
Finally, the third route, which is a very subtle one. Someone helped my enemy, my rival, or someone I despise in the past.
Or they are aiding them right now, or they will help them in the future.
That completes the 9 causes.
If you examine any moment of resentment or outrage you feel, you will find it fits perfectly into one of these 9 boxes.
It is a comprehensive map of the terrain of our ego's defenses.
It really is. It covers every possible excuse the ego can invent to justify hostility.
But here is where the teaching pivots, and where Khyentse Rinpoche gives us a profoundly practical tool for our daily practice.
Beyond those 9 external triggers.
Right, the things people actually do to us. There is a primary proximate cause of anger that lives entirely inside us.
Rinpoche identifies this internal condition as mental unhappiness.
He calls this mental unhappiness the nourishment or the crucial fuel for anger.
This concept of mental unhappiness is arguably the most important mechanism to understand if we want to stop anger from arising.
Because mental unhappiness is not full-blown anger, right?
Oh, no, not at all. It is that baseline state of dissatisfaction.
It is that internal, low-grade irritation, that subtle brooding over things not being exactly as we want them to be.
It could be dissatisfaction with your job, the weather, your health.
Or just a vague sense of unease.
Rinpoche teaches that the greater the reservoir of mental unhappiness, the greater the potential for a catastrophic explosion of anger.
I always like to visualize this mental unhappiness like a massive pile of dry kindling sitting right in the center of the mind.
That's a great image.
The external triggers those nine causes, like someone insulting us or cutting us off in traffic.
Or sending a passive-aggressive email.
Right. Those external events are just sparks. They are nothing but tiny, momentary sparks.
And if your mind is joyful, spacious, and grounded in patience, there is no kindling.
So when the spark of an insult lands, it lands on wet stone.
It just fizzles out.
You notice it, but nothing catches fire.
But if you have been walking around all week nursing this deep mental unhappiness, you are stressed about money, you are annoyed at your spouse.
You didn't sleep well, you are compiling a mental list of how unfair the world is.
You are just piling up dry kindling.
Then the exact same spark hits. A stranger bumps into you at the grocery store. Boom, the entire mind goes up in flames.
You explode at them.
But the reality is, the external provocation couldn't have started a fire of that magnitude without the fuel that you yourself provided.
That analogy perfectly captures Rinpoche's practical advice here.
Yeah.
And his solution is brilliantly straightforward.
He states that just as intentionally reducing our daily food intake naturally reduces our physical body weight over time.
Intentionally reducing our baseline mental unhappiness literally starves our potential for anger.
We have to become incredibly vigilant.
We have to identify that inner fuel of dissatisfaction the moment it starts pooling in our mind, and we have to neutralize it.
We must starve the fire.
Because if we don't feed the mental unhappiness, the anger simply cannot sustain itself. It has no biological or psychological fuel.
But, you know, that raises a massive flashing neon question for me.
What's that?
It's easy to say reduce mental unhappiness, but how?
Right, in the real world.
If mental unhappiness is the fuel, how do we actually remove it when we are in the thick of life? Especially when we're actively being harmed.
It's the ultimate test.
If someone is looking me in the eye and saying cruel, harsh words to me, or if I am actively losing something precious to me because of someone else's negligence.
How are you supposed to just not feel mental unhappiness?
Exactly. Khyentse Rinpoche doesn't just say take a deep breath.
No, he points us to the ultimate definitive antidote, the infallible law of cause and effect.
He brings us face to face with karma and dependent arising.
This brings us to what is perhaps the most challenging, yet ultimately the most liberating teaching in the entire text.
When we experience harm, be it physical violence, verbal abuse, or material loss,
our deep, instinctual, habitual response is to blame the person standing in front of us.
They are the source of my pain.
But Rinpoche explains that according to the Buddha's realization, the person harming us is not the main cause of our suffering.
Let me repeat that because it is so counterintuitive. The person harming us is not the main cause.
Correct. In the precise language of Buddhist philosophy, the harmer is merely what is called a cooperative condition.
A cooperative condition.
The actual primary main cause of our suffering is our own past negative karma ripening in that exact moment.
Okay, I have to push back here. Hard.
I expect nothing less.
Because I know exactly what happens when modern people, especially those new to this path, hear this concept for the first time.
It can be very jarring.
To modern ears, steeped in psychology and concepts of social justice, this sounds dangerously uncomfortably close to blaming the victim.
Yes, that is the common reaction.
If someone steals my car, or worse, if someone physically assaults me and you tell me, well, the main cause of that assault was your own past negative action.
Your immediate reaction is revulsion.
It sounds like you are saying you deserved it.
It feels like we are absolving the attacker of their moral responsibility.
And heaping guilt onto the person who was just victimized. How do we, as serious practitioners, understand this profound teaching without falling into a toxic pit of guilt, self-hatred, or despair?
It is an absolutely vital question, and it is the exact place where so many Western students stumble.
So how do we reframe it?
To understand this, without falling into the trap of victim blaming, We must completely and ruthlessly strip away any lingering Judeo-Christian notions of divine reward and punishment.
Okay, so get rid of the cosmic judge idea.
Exactly. Karma is not a cosmic judge sitting on a cloud handing down sentences because you were bad.
Karma has no moral judgment.
None. Karma is a universal law of nature. It is spiritual physics. It is simply the law of cause and effect operating at the subtle level of consciousness.
So it's more like gravity than a courtroom.
Exactly. If you step off a roof, gravity pulls you down.
Gravity isn't punishing you for being on the roof.
It is simply operating according to its nature. Kinsarin Posh clarifies this distinction between a main cause and a cooperative condition using very everyday, tangible examples.
Like what?
Think about food poisoning.
Yeah.
Let's say you go to a restaurant, you eat a piece of tainted food, and you get a terrible, agonizing case of food poisoning.
Okay, awful experience.
Now, what caused your illness? The food is the cooperative condition. It is the immediate trigger.
But according to the deep law of karma,
the main cause, the underlying karmic root that resulted in you experiencing that specific suffering at that specific time, is a past negative action you committed.
The tainted food was just the delivery system for the karma to ripen.
Conversely, if you eat a fantastic meal and it brings you immense pleasure, health, and vitality, the food is, again, just a cooperative condition.
The root cause of experiencing that pleasure is your own past positive karma.
Yes.
He even quotes the great 4th century master Vasubandhu on this.
He does. And Vasubandhu makes this mind-bending assertion that all the infinite varieties of objects in the world, everything we experience in our environment, down to the existence of a mere random pebble resting on the ground, arises in dependence upon the collective and individual karma of sentient beings.
Wait, down to a random pebble?
It is an infallible mechanical law. The environment itself is a manifestation of karmic imprints.
That is just incredible. So apply this back to the person harming you.
The person yelling at you, insulting you, or stealing from you is the cooperative condition.
They are the tainted food.
But here is the radical shift. They cannot cause you to experience the suffering of being harmed unless you have the karmic seed for that exact suffering already residing in your own mind stream.
If you had completely purified your negative karma, that person could scream at you all day and you would experience absolutely no mental suffering.
And this is the turning point. Understanding this mechanism is what instantly evaporates the fuel of mental unhappiness.
Why? Because when we truly internalize this, the narrative of victimization completely collapses.
There is literally no one outside of ourselves to legitimately blame.
If I go out into my garden and I intentionally plant the seed of a highly toxic, poisonous weed, and then a month later, a toxic plant grows in my garden, who do I get angry at?
You can't blame the weather.
Do I run outside and scream at the sun and the rain for watering my seed? Do I curse the soil?
The person harming me is just the sun and the rain.
They are providing the conditions. But I planted the seed of suffering through my own past harmful actions.
When we deeply meditatively realize this, the burning sense of injustice, which is the core of our mental unhappiness, just dissolves.
The kindling is soaked with water.
It completely reframes our relationship to adversity. The harmer is no longer an unjust aggressor ruining our perfect life.
They're simply the mechanism by which our own karmic debt is being cleared.
Yes.
The sun and the rain. I just love that analogy for cooperative conditions.
Very helpful.
But of course, Shantideva knows that our minds are incredibly stubborn. We don't want to let go of our righteous indignation.
We love our anger. It feels powerful. It feels protective.
We don't want to rely on faith in karma alone because in the heat of the moment, karma feels abstract.
And the jerk yelling at us feels very real.
So Shantideva doesn't ask us to rely on faith.
No. In chapter 6, he uses rigorous, airtight, philosophical logic to prove that anger is inherently fundamentally irrational.
Kinsir Rinpoche walks us through 4 specific philosophical arguments from the text. I like to think of this as Shantideva's surgical deconstruction of resentment.
Let's really take our time and explore these 4 arguments together because they are brilliant.
They really are masterpieces of analytical meditation. The first of Shantideva's arguments is the famous stick analogy.
Right. Imagine someone comes up to you and hits you hard with a wooden stick.
Ouch.
What is actually causing you the direct, immediate physical pain?
It is the stick. The wood is what is bruising your skin.
But do you get furiously angry at the stick? Do you curse the wood and vow revenge against it?
Of course not. That would be insane.
You get angry at the person wielding the stick because you recognize that the stick has no freedom, no autonomy.
It is merely an instrument being entirely controlled by the person.
We all agree on that.
Mm-hmm.
But then Shantideva takes that exact same logic and pushes it one devastating step further.
He argues that if you look closely at the mind of the person wielding the stick, you will see that they also have no freedom.
They are completely and utterly controlled by their own afflictive emotions, by their anger, their jealousy, their profound ignorance.
They are acting as instruments of their own delusion.
So Shanna Davis says, if we forgive the spick because it is controlled by the person, logical consistency demands that we must forgive the person because they are controlled by the hatred.
If we are going to be angry at anything, if we absolutely must direct our rage somewhere, we should be angry at the affliction of hatred itself.
Not the enslaved person who is currently acting under its tyrannical command.
It is a profound shift in perspective. It separates the person from the pathology.
Shantideva reminds us that the Buddha taught that sentient beings are not the true source of harm. The afflictive emotions within them are the source.
The person yelling at you is essentially a hostage to their own rage.
And this leads directly into the second philosophical argument, which Rinpoche outlines the tragedy of self-harm.
This one is so deeply moving, and it really shifts the mind from anger to profound compassion.
Rinpoche points out that when human beings fall under the influence of deep delusion and heavy afflictive emotions, they do terrible, unthinkable things to themselves.
We see this all the time. People fall into severe addiction, they destroy their physical bodies with poison, they jump off cliffs, they commit suicide.
They systematically destroy their own wealth, their careers, and their most cherished relationships.
Driven by mental afflictions, they harm the one thing they naturally treasure most in the entire universe, their own precious life.
The logic here is devastatingly clear. If an internal afflictive emotion is so overwhelmingly powerful that it can drive a person to murder their own precious self or destroy their own family,
why in the world are we shocked or indignant when that exact same afflictive emotion drives them to harm us, a total stranger? Or a mere acquaintance.
Right. We take it so personally. We think, how could they do this to me?
Exactly. But it's not about you. We are just bystanders getting caught in the crossfire of their internal tragedy.
The only logical, rational response to witnessing someone so deeply enslaved by delusion that they are creating hellish karma for themselves is deep, overwhelming compassion.
Anger in that scenario is simply absurd.
It's like getting angry at a drowning person who thrashes out and accidentally hits you while they are suffocating.
They aren't trying to hurt you, they are drowning.
They are drowning in their own karma. Which brings us to the third argument regarding the nature of the childish person.
And Rinpoche uses these two beautiful contrasting analogies here to cover all the bases of human behavior.
First, he says, imagine you are dealing with a person who is fundamentally childish, deeply ignorant, or just has a chronic, lifelong nature of causing harm.
We all know people who are just consistently toxic.
Shanna Davis says getting angry at them for harming you is as foolish as putting your hand in a fire and then getting angry at the fire for burning you.
It is the very nature of fire to burn. It has no other way of being.
You don't resent the fire, you just recognize its nature and act wisely around it. You don't expect fire to be water.
And then Rinpoche provides the other side of that coin. Suppose you are harmed by a normally reliable, kind, good-hearted person who is just temporarily under the sway of an afflictive emotion.
They are having a terrible day, they are under immense stress, and they snap at you.
Rinpoche says that getting angry at them in this scenario is like resenting the vast open sky because a cloud of dark smoke has temporarily arisen within it.
The smoke is not the fundamental nature of the sky. It is a temporary, fleeting manifestation dependent on passing conditions.
In both cases, whether the harm stems from their unexamined chronic nature or whether it's just a passing cloud in a normally clear sky anger is a completely irrational, unhelpful response.
It's just a flawless dismantling of our justifications.
And then there is the fourth argument, drawn from Rinpoche's March 1989 sessions,
which deals with something almost all of us secretly crave, especially in the modern era of social media praise, fame, and reputation.
This argument really cuts at the ego. When someone insults us or ruins our reputation or embarrasses us publicly, our default response is intense, burning anger.
We feel our very self has been attacked.
But Rinpoche, echoing Shantideva, says that getting euphoric over praise and depressed over insults is essentially the mentality of a child building sandcastles.
It is a profound delusion, because we have to ask ourselves, what does praise actually do to a spiritual practitioner?
Does it grant you longer life? Does it increase your strength? Does it cure your illnesses?
No. What it actually does is breed pride. It breeds arrogance, complacency, and jealousy.
But most dangerously, from a Dharma perspective, praise completely ruins our disillusionment with cyclic existence.
We start thinking, hey, samsara isn't so bad. People love me here. I'm respected. I'm comfortable.
Praise acts as an anesthetic, binding us tighter and tighter to the wheel of suffering.
This blew my mind. Therefore, Shantideva argues, the person who insults us, the person who tears down our precious reputation, the person who exposes our flaws, they are actually protecting us.
They are cutting the anchor of our pride. They are shattering the illusion that worldly success can save us.
Rinpo says that by destroying our attachment to fame, our enemies are literally protecting us from the causes of lower rebirths.
It is an incredible reversal of worldly values. The internet troll or the toxic coworker who is tearing down your reputation is effectively acting as your fierce Dharma protector.
Rinpo says that for a practitioner genuinely seeking liberation, the people who cause us suffering are bestowing the great waves of the blessings of the Buddhas upon us.
Why? Because it is in response to them in the crucible of their opposition that we will forge the patience necessary to achieve Buddhahood.
We will never achieve enlightenment by hanging out with friends who flatter us and tell us how spiritual we are.
And that realization serves as a vital transition point in the text. We have just walked through four profound arguments that serve to neutralize our anger.
They bring us back to zero.
But Shantideva does not let us stop at mere neutrality. We are discussing the Mahayana path, the path of the Bodhisattva.
On this path, it is simply not enough to just not be angry.
Tolerating someone through gritted teeth is not the perfection of patience.
We must actively, genuinely cherish the person who harms us. We are flipping the paradigm completely. We must view the harmer as an irreplaceable, priceless treasure.
Let's really emphasize this because it is perhaps the most radical teaching in the entire Bodhicarya Avatara.
Rinpoche teaches that the person who harms you is the unique cause of your practice of patience.
Think deeply about that. Without a harmer, the perfection of patience cannot be practiced.
It is literally impossible to practice patience when everyone is being nice to you.
And without completing the perfection of patience, achieving Buddhahood is impossible.
Therefore, logically, the harmer is an absolutely indispensable ingredient for your own enlightenment. You need them just as much as you need a teacher.
Khyentse Rinpoche illustrates this beautifully by talking about the scarcity of the harmer.
If you want to practice the perfection of generosity, you can step outside your door. Objects of generosity are everywhere.
Rinpoche notes that in India, beggars line the streets, charities abound globally. You can give away your wealth, your time, or your possessions at any moment of any day.
But an object of your patience, a person who genuinely deeply harms you, who gets under your skin in a way that truly tests your spiritual mettle, serving is the precise ripening of your specific past negative karma.
That is incredibly rare.
It is so rare that when such a person appears in your life, you should realize you haven't even had to go out looking for them.
They just arrived on your doorstep.
The Bodhisattva's reaction to this is not dread, it is joy.
Shantideva says it should be the exact feeling of discovering a priceless buried treasure that just magically appeared in your living room without you having to dig for it.
You don't lament the treasure, you rejoice.
You think, ah, the exact specific karmic condition I needed to practice patience, to burn through my negative karma, and to accumulate massive merit has arrived. How incredibly fortunate I am.
This profound attitude is perfectly illustrated by the famous Jataka tale of Shakyamuni Buddha in a previous life, when he was still a bodhisattva traversing the path.
He is walking in the forest and encounters a starving tigress.
She is so emaciated, so maddened and weakened by hunger, that she is on the verge of devouring her own newborn cubs just to survive.
The bodhisattva looks at this scene and is moved by an unbearable, shattering compassion. He recognizes that the tigress is trapped by her karma, driven by the affliction of hunger.
So what does he do? He voluntarily offers his own physical body to the tigress so she and her cubs can live, and so she doesn't create the horrific karma of eating her own young.
This is the ultimate unimaginable practice of patience and generosity in the face of literal physical destruction.
It is a staggering story. But the real lesson is the karmic result of that act of supreme patience.
Fast forward eons later, the Bodhisattva finally attains full enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, becoming Shakyamuni Buddha.
He travels to the Deer Park in Varanasi to give his very first teaching, the turning of the wheel of Dharma.
And who are his first five human disciples? Who are the first beings to receive the nectar of liberation from his lips?
Through the infallible mechanics of karma, they are the reincarnations of those five tiger cubs.
That is the profound, unbreakable karmic bond forged through the perfection of patience.
The teaching here is that you are literally gathering your future disciples, your future retinue, through how you endure harm from them today.
When you practice patience with an enemy, you're planting the karmic seed to one day liberate them.
It is a stunning vision of interconnectedness. But here, the intellectual debating mind of the student usually raises an objection.
Shantideva, being a master debater, anticipates it perfectly.
The student says, "Okay, I understand that practicing patience brings me merit, but the harmer doesn't intend to help me practice patience."
Their intention is malicious. They want to see me suffer.
Why should I hold them in such high regard, like a precious treasure, when they actively, consciously wish me ill?
I absolutely love Shantideva's rebuttal here. It is a brilliant philosophical counterpunch.
He says, "Okay, let's look at the Holy Dharma itself. We take refuge in the Dharma, we venerate the texts, we bow to the teachings of emptiness."
But does the Dharma have an intention to benefit us? Does the abstract concept of emptiness possess a mind that wishes us well?
Does the Sutra deliberately want to help us?
No. The Dharma is inanimate. It has no intention whatsoever. Yet, we venerate it as the supreme path to liberation. We hold it as the highest refuge.
Exactly. The logic is flawless. The harmer is an equally necessary condition for our liberation as the Dharma is.
We cannot achieve Buddhahood without the teachings of the Dharma, and we cannot achieve Buddhahood without the harmer providing the condition to practice patience.
Since both are equally necessary, indispensable facilities for our path, both deserve our deepest equal regard and veneration, regardless of whether they possess a benevolent intention.
And this reverence for the harmer doesn't just stop at the individual enemy, it scales up dramatically.
It expands into what I think is one of the most sublime, breathtaking views in all of Mahayana Buddhism.
And this is a teaching Khenpo Rinpoche elaborated on in great detail during his May and June sessions in 1989.
The absolute fundamental equality of the Buddhas and ordinary sentient beings.
To truly grasp this equality, we have to look at the mechanics of awakening itself. Achieving full Buddhahood requires a practitioner to complete two vast collections.
The collection of positive potential, or merit, and the collection of sublime wisdom.
How are these two immense collections accumulated?
Rinpoche explains that this entire process depends 50% on the Buddhas and 50% on ordinary, deluded, sentient beings.
It's the classic analogy of the two wings of a bird. You cannot fly to the state of liberation with only one wing.
You can have all the devotion in the world to the Buddhas. You can sit in a pristine temple, make millions of prostrations, recite millions of mantras, and offer oceans of incense.
But without interacting with, serving, and practicing patience with messy, angry, deluded, difficult, sentient beings, you will never, ever reach enlightenment.
The Buddhas provide the inspiration and the methods. But sentient beings provide the actual laboratory where the work is done.
The Buddha himself used a very earthy analogy for this, the farmer and the field.
A farmer deeply respects, tends to, and cherishes his field. Why? Because that dirt, that muddy soil, is the absolute source of his livelihood, his wealth, and his family's survival.
He doesn't despise the dirt for being dirty. He venerates it for its potential.
In the exact same way, ordinary sentient beings are the field from which our spiritual harvest of Buddhahood grows. We must hold every single being, especially the difficult ones, as precious as the farmer holds his land.
This level of radical devotion to sentient beings leads to practices that are almost unfathomable to our ordinary self-cherishing minds.
Rinpoche tells the story of Geshe Sarawak, the great Kadampa master of mind training.
Geshe Sarawak spent his entire life deeply engaging in the practice of exchanging self for others. He made one specific fervent prayer every single day.
He prayed to be reborn in the deepest, most agonizing hell realms.
He didn't want a good rebirth. He wanted to go to hell, just so he could remain there to take on the suffering of even a single sentient being, to provide them some relief.
And the profound irony, the beautiful karmic result of such pure, selfless bodhicitta, is that when Geshe Sarawak died, his mind was so completely free of self-cherishing that a lower rebirth was karmically impossible.
The heavy negative karma required for a hell rebirth simply didn't exist in him.
Instead, a radiant pure land appeared to receive him. The story goes that he was actually deeply disappointed.
He wept because he felt his prayer to serve beings in hell hadn't been answered, simply because the sheer massive merit of his selfless wish propelled him straight to a pure land.
That is the ultimate proof of the power of cherishing others. It overrides everything else.
And Rinpoche beautifully summarizes this relationship between the Buddhas, ourselves, and sentient beings with an analogy that I think touches the heart of anyone who has ever been a parent or loved a child deeply.
Rinpoche says, imagine the Buddhas are like infinitely loving parents, and all sentient beings, every single one of us, are their beloved, precious children.
Now, if you want to please a parent, what is the best way to do it? You can go to them directly and offer them gifts, praise them, give them expensive incense or jewelry.
They will be polite. They will be somewhat pleased, of course.
But if you truly, deeply want to delight a parent's heart to its absolute core, what do? You care for their children.
You feed their children when they are hungry. You protect them when they are in danger. You show them unconditional love.
That is the greatest possible offering. Offering incense and prostrations to the Buddhas delights them only slightly compared to the overwhelming joy they feel when we genuinely care for, serve, and practice patience with their children, sentient beings.
Because whatever we do to the children reaches the parents as pleasure or pain.
If you get angry and harm a sentient being, you are actively harming the Buddha's beloved child right in front of them, and then turning around and offering the Buddha a stick of incense, expecting a blessing.
It's hypocritical, it's absurd, and it completely violates the Bodhisattva vow.
Having established this vast, magnificent philosophical view of interconnectedness, equality, and the necessity of the harmer, Khenpsur Rinpoche then performs a crucial task for his students.
He brings this soaring philosophy all the way back down to the meditation cushion.
He asks, how does a practitioner systematically categorize and physically train in this perfection?
In his sessions from late 1988 and mid-1989, he outlines three specific types of patience that we must cultivate.
Right. Let's go through these three types because they provide the actual roadmap for our daily practice. This is what it looks like on Tuesday morning.
The first type is what we usually think of when we hear the word patience. Not retaliating.
Not retaliating means exactly what it sounds like, enduring harm directed at you, whether it is harm of physical violence, verbal abuse, or mental malice, and consciously, deliberately choosing not to return it.
And Khenpsur Rinpoche sets the ultimate standard here. This isn't just about ignoring a rude comment at the grocery store or taking a deep breath when someone cuts you off in traffic.
The Bodhisattva standard is this: even if all the beings in the three realms of existence were to simultaneously rise up against you as bitter enemies, speaking harshly to you, beating you, or even killing you, you maintain the thought, it doesn't matter.
This is the ripening of my own karma. I will not retaliate. I will only respond with compassion.
It is a staggering, almost terrifying standard. But that is the vow of a Mahayana practitioner.
The second type of patience moves from enduring harm inflicted by others to something even more proactive, voluntarily accepting suffering.
This is the willingness to enthusiastically endure the physical and mental hardships required for authentic Dharma practice.
The prime historical example here, as Rinpoche points out, is the great Tibetan yogi Milarepa.
For the sake of his practice, to achieve enlightenment in a single lifetime, Milarepa voluntarily lived in a high-altitude freezing cave with the barest of conditions.
He wore thin, torn cotton clothing in the dead of winter. He ate nothing but stinging nettles until his physical skin literally turned green and he was emaciated.
He endured freezing cold, burning heat, and total isolation.
But we have to highlight a vital distinction Rinpoche makes here. Because a modern skeptic might look at Milarepa and say, well, worldly people endure terrible hardships too.
People work grueling jobs in freezing conditions to make a paycheck. Soldiers endure the unspeakable horrors of war. Athletes push their bodies to the breaking point. What makes Milarepa's suffering any different or more holy?
The difference is the result. Worldly suffering cycles endlessly.
You suffer in a miserable job to make money, you eventually die, you lose all the money, you take rebirth in samsara, and you have to suffer to survive all over again. It has no definitive end.
But suffering endured voluntarily for the sake of the Dharma, waking up early to meditate when you are tired, enduring the pain in your knees during retreat, fasting, maintaining strict ethical vows when it is inconvenient that suffering has a definitive, final end.
It culminates in ultimate liberation. It is a temporary investment that pays off permanently, forever breaking the cycle of rebirth.
Which brings us to the third type of patience, and this is one that is so frequently overlooked in Western Buddhism. It is called abiding in the Dharma.
Yes. This is perhaps my favorite one. This is the profound intellectual and spiritual stamina required for the path.
It is the patience of deeply, relentlessly examining difficult, counterintuitive phenomena without turning away.
We are talking about the mental grit required to meditate on the infallible law of cause and effect when your life is falling apart.
The patience to meditate on the horrific disadvantages of cyclic existence without falling into nihilism or depression.
And most importantly, the endurance required to analyze the profound, subtle view of emptiness and dependent arising.
It takes immense tolerance and endurance to look at the true nature of reality without flinching. To sit on the cushion and systematically dismantle your own ego.
To use logic to realize that the inherently existent self you cherish so dearly, the I that you spend all day defending, lacks any true independent existence that is genuinely terrifying to the ordinary mind.
It feels like stepping off a cliff into an abyss.
Abiding in the Dharma is the patience to endure that intellectual terror and psychological discomfort, to persevere in the rigorous examination of phenomena until the dawn of realization breaks through the darkness of ignorance.
It is the absolute grit of the meditator.
So we have traversed an immense amount of ground today. We have explored the cosmic devastation of anger and its dual negativity.
We've looked at the mechanics of mental unhappiness and the dry kindling.
We walked through Shantideva's surgical deconstruction of our excuses, the stick, the tragedy of self-harm, the childish person.
We explored the radical viewing of the harmer as a treasure, the profound equality of Buddhas and beings, and the three practical types of patience.
As we draw to a close, let's transition into synthesizing Khenpo Rinpoche's final instructions for our daily practice. How do we take this monumental 1,200-year-old teaching and apply it to our immediate, chaotic, modern lives today?
Rinpoche leaves us with several vital, actionable practice points. The first is to appoint an inner spy.
Just as an army in hostile territory places a vigilant lookout on a high hill to watch for the enemy's approach, you must appoint a corner of your own awareness to constantly monitor your mind.
You have to catch anger when it is small, when it is just a whisper of irritation, a slight tightening in the chest, or a judgment forming.
If you catch it then, you can easily pacify it with logic or breath. But if you abandon your post and wait until the fire is blazing out of your eyes and mouth, it is too late. You have lost control and the merit is destroyed.
And part of helping that inner spy do its job is the second point preparation.
If you know you are going into a difficult situation, maybe you have a meeting with a notoriously toxic boss, or you are visiting a family member who always knows exactly how to push your buttons, you not just walk in blindly and hope for the best.
You set your motivation firmly beforehand.
You sit in your car for 2 minutes before going inside, and you tell yourself, no matter what this person says or does today, I'm going to remain aware.
They are my object of practice. I will not give them the power to make me angry and destroy my peace.
Rinpoche says the first time you try this, you will probably fail. But through repetition, you build the neural and karmic pathways of patience. It becomes a habit.
Another critical practical point is discerning action versus release. Cultivating patience does absolutely not mean becoming a passive doormat or allowing injustice to flourish.
When a difficult situation arises, you must assess it calmly with a clear mind. Ask yourself, can this situation be fixed? Can I act to benefit others or prevent harm here?
If the answer is yes, then act. Set a boundary, speak up, fix the problem. Doing so with a calm mind focused on benefit actually prevents anger from arising.
But if the answer is no, if the event is in the past or absolutely nothing can be done to change it, then you must let it go completely.
Rehearsing the grievance in your mind, playing the argument over and over in your head while you're in the shower, planning what you should have said that only generates massive mental unhappiness and feeds the fire of future anger.
And finally, for those of us actively aspiring to practice bodhicitta, we have the ultimate overarching framing, the mother beings.
We must continuously remember that in the infinite, boundless expanse of beginningless time, we have taken countless rebirths.
Because our past lives are infinite in number, it is a mathematical certainty that every single being we encounter, including the person currently screaming at us, has at some point in the past been our profoundly kind mother.
They have carried us in their womb. They have fed us from their own body. They have protected us from danger. And they have loved us more than their own lives.
Therefore, harboring anger toward a mother who is currently suffering from the delusion of her own afflictions is never appropriate.
Our task is not to defeat them. Our task is to become their servant, to care for them, and ultimately to guide them to awakening.
It is a radical, beautiful, and profoundly challenging way to walk through the world.
It truly is.
As we conclude our deep dive into Khenpo Rinpoche's transmission of Shantideva's wisdom on patience, we want to leave you, the listener, with a challenging, lingering reflection to take with you today.
Think about your life right now. Consider the specific person who causes you the most distress.
The one whose name makes your stomach drop or your chest tighten? It could be a politician, an ex-partner, a boss?
What if, rather than an unfair obstacle to your happiness, they are the exact precious condition that you subconsciously requested.
What if their difficult grading behavior is the very grindstone you need to sharpen the blade of your own patience, burning through your negative karma and propelling you directly toward your own awakening?
It changes everything.
Until we meet again, we wish you profound joy, unshakable peace, and steady perseverance in your ongoing study and practice of the Dharma.